I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is food science writer Harold McGee. He's joined in conversation by Brian Garrick. And now, join Brian Garrick on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Harold McGee.
Harold McGee writes about the science of food and cooking. He began this journey after studies at Caltech and Yale University, where he taught literature and writing. In 1984, he switched career paths and published the 680-page compendium on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. On Food and Cooking became a landmark reference tool for legions of home and professional chefs eager to understand ingredients and techniques. In 1990, he published a shorter and more personal book, The Curious Cook, More Kitchen Science and Lore. Then in 2004, he published the second completely revised and significantly expanded edition of On Food and Cooking, which garnered him the James Beard Award as it was entered into the Cookbook Hall of Fame. His latest book is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Harold has contributed reviews and original research to the scientific journal Nature and has written many articles for publications, including his regular column in the New York Times, The Curious Cook. He's taught courses at the French Culinary Institute in New York, and recently he participated in the Science and Cooking Lecture Series at Harvard University alongside world-class chefs and food experts. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Harold McGee. So Harold, welcome.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here, Brian.
So your orientation to food is science-based, but you're not trained as a scientist. So how and why did you become a food scientist?
Well, I didn't become a food scientist. I became a food science writer. There is a profession of food scientists. They have PhD programs, and they would be very upset if I passed myself off as a food scientist. So essentially what happened was I loved science very much from an early age, and that's why I went to Caltech. You don't go to Caltech because you're interested in history. But then I discovered, as a number of us do every year, once you're immersed in that program, that maybe science really wasn't what you were most interested in after all. The great thing about Caltech, though, was that they have wonderful majors in the humanities. And so I was able to stay there, study literature, but then kind of cherry-pick the science classes that I wanted to. And so I kept that interest in science alive. And then fast-forwarding to my brief career as a literature instructor, after a few years of trying to get a tenure-track position and not succeeding, I thought maybe I could recoup my investment in science and find a different career path by writing about the science of everyday life. And I picked food as my first subject because it was something we could all do something with. You know, if I'd written about the weather, all you can do is suffer it. You can understand it and suffer. With food, you can learn something about it and then do something and make something delicious. And so that's why I started with food.
And then what led you to write this big 680-page tome on food and cooking?
That was kind of an accident. when I first thought of the idea of writing about the science of food, I thought initially of a kind of Q&A format, you know, interesting facts that will help you make better brownies and that kind of thing. But then I started to do the research, and because I'd been a literature student interested especially in literary history, I found myself, you know, I would go to this wonderful library in Boston, the Schlesinger Library, which Julia Child donated all of her books and manuscripts to. It's a library for the study of women in history, but they have a huge section devoted to food and cooking. So I went there to get an idea of what sorts of things I should cover, and began to find interesting patterns in the way people cooked and how that would change with time. So when I finally met in a preliminary way with a publisher about this idea, and I told him some of these anecdotes, he listened to me patiently and then said, okay, it sounds like a good idea, and I want to publish your book, but I want you to make sure that those stories that you told me about the history and the culture are in there too, because that's going to make the science go down easy. And that was all the incentive I needed, because that's what I love to do, is spend my life in libraries learning about stuff and then sharing it with other people. So he's the one who really got me to thinking of a book that would be less Q&A and more kind of encyclopedic, a kind of rounded view of the subject.
So how was it received when it was first published?
Well, it really wasn't. It was delivered, but it didn't get reviewed. There were cooking magazines and awards for best books by cooking magazines, and those came and went, and it got no attention. Because at that time, 1984, it was weird to look at food that way. There's no doubt about it. And the publicity that I did get at the time focused on the weirdness. So I did get a nice spread in People magazine, but, you know, it was a full-page picture of me looking cross-eyed at a test tube with eggs in it. So not what I had hoped. The initial reception was not what I had hoped. But then about a year after it came out, Mimi Sheraton wrote a one-page piece in Time magazine about it. She called me ahead of time to ask me questions, and it felt like the third degree over the phone. I was convinced that she was going to tear it apart, say, what is this supplying science to food? You're destroying. It's what I'd heard from most chefs, in fact, was this is a craft. It's an art. It has nothing to do with science. Leave it alone. That's what I thought she was going to do, and instead she said very nice things about it. And it was from that time, about a year after it came out, that people began to pay attention.
And then 20 years later, you revised it and had a significantly updated edition. So what changed about the food world, and what led you to dive back into that volume?
Well, a huge amount had changed, and for that I will be eternally grateful, because, as I say, when I first wrote the book, there was not much interest. Not just in the science of food and cooking, but food and cooking in general. I mean, I see people in this room who are, you know, approximately my age, a little bit younger, and back in the 70s, food in the United States was a very different sort of proposition. There were no specialty coffee drinks back then. I wrote the first draft of this book on an electric typewriter because there was no such thing as a personal computer. It was just a completely different world. And so between 1984 and 1994, when I signed the contract to do the revision, even that 10 years was amazing. And the fact that the publishers came back to me and said, you have to revise this, you have to update it, you have to expand it, because interest in food had just grown so much. And people, they knew a lot more about food than they did when I wrote the book the first time around. So I had to go into greater depth, as well as cover in greater breadth to make it a useful book.
So how many pages does it stand now?
Well, not that many more. It's the first, as you say, was 600-some. The second is maybe 800-some. But we crowd the pages are bigger, and the words are smaller, so it's about 2/3 longer than it was the first time around.
And in on food and cooking, you famously debunked the myth that high heat sears in the juices on meat, and so why is that wrong?
It's wrong because it's wrong. I mean,
Well, what actually happens?
If you take a piece of meat, and I actually have fun with this when I give talks to gatherings of chefs, because you do see chefs on TV these days who really do seem to be up on things, but it is a profession that has been very slow to change, and so I've given talks at conventions, collocations of professional chefs. And I have fun by asking them at the very beginning, how many of you think that searing meat seals in the juices? And 90% of the hands in the room go up. And then I show them pictures of me searing a piece of meat and then putting it on a plate and tilting the plate and watching what happens, which is something all of them have done hundreds of times. The juices pour out, unless you've overcooked it to the point that it has no juices left. So then I take another poll. How many of you think searing meat seals in the juices? No hands. It's just a matter of using your own experience and not listening to the so-called experts, me included. I've made mistakes, who tell you this is the way things are. If your own experience in the kitchen tells you something different, your own experience is probably right.
So how do we make sure our meat is juicy?
By not cooking it above 140 degrees Fahrenheit in the center.
That applies very to simple. All cuts?
That applies to, as far as juiciness goes, yes. Now, there are some cuts of meat that you don't necessarily want to cook to that low a temperature, or cuts that you may want not to cook to that high a temperature. Anything 140 or below will be juicy. Anything 145 to 150 and above, I'm giving you some wiggle room there, is going to be dry.
But a lot of the flavor comes from the caramelization that you get on the meat and mm-hmm. get in other things, and there are these browning reactions.
Yeah.
And what exactly are they?
Well, the browning reactions are, that's the paradox or the difficulty in meat cooking, is that you only get browning reactions at really high temperatures, way above 140. So, if you wanted to guarantee that you're going to get a juicy piece of meat, you would cook it at 140 degrees, and then it could never get any hotter, right? So you'd be, there's no way to overcook it. Problem with that is that you're essentially stewing it or steaming it. It's not really, or poaching it even, not even stewing. It's not going to have any of those wonderful browning reaction flavors that you get from grilling and frying and so on. So to get those flavors, you have to get the temperature way above the boiling point of water. So 400, 500, 600, 700 degrees. And the higher the temperature, the faster they go. So the best compromise, browning on the outside, juicy on the inside, is very, very high temperature sear to get the flavor, but not to lock in the juices. And then temperature way down and cook it at your leisure, slowly, just to 140 degrees.
But I've also read from you that these browning reactions occur more in a more of an alkaline environment. Is that right?
It is, yes.
So baking soda, is that the answer? Put that on your meat?
Very good question. So, you know how pretzels have a very particular flavor to them, unlike other baked goods. And that unusual flavor comes from the use of an alkaline ingredient in the water in which the pretzels are initially dunked before they're baked. So that's the flavor of browning reactions that take place under alkaline conditions. And they're great on a pretzel because we're kind of used to them on a pretzel. If you try the experiment of, and I've done it so you don't have to do it, putting a paste of baking soda on a piece of meat to speed up the browning reactions, you get just a god-awful tasting piece of meat. So there are people who claim that if you're, say, frying ground beef and you add just a little pinch of baking soda, that can enhance the browning of the meat and give you a brown flavor faster. That I believe, but because I know how easy it is to get bad flavors from baking soda, I don't think it's worth it. I think you just want to cook it at a high enough temperature to get the flavor you're used to and you want.
What if I'm caramelizing onions? Can I put a pinch in?
You can, and the baking soda will also soften the onions, and if you add a little bit too much, turn them into mush. Mm-hmm. So baking soda is strong stuff. It's, you know, one of those ingredients where you forget about quarter teaspoons. It really is a pinch, and it's much better to have a scale that goes down to like a tenth of a gram so that you really don't overdo it.
Okay. Now, what about your new book? Why did you write this one?
I wrote Keys to Good Cooking because I've had plenty of professional chefs and home cooks tell me that they love On Food and Cooking. All kinds of great information in there. But if they're in the kitchen and something isn't working and they want to understand what's going on and they try to find the relevant paragraph in On Food and Cooking, by the time they find it, it's done. So they asked me to write something that was a little more pointed, a little more practical. And that's what I did in Keys to Good Cooking. So there's really not much in the way of interesting information apart from, if you're trying to do X, do it this way and not that way, with maybe a phrase of explanation. But just so that you have a problem, you can find the answer quickly, close the book, put it back on the shelf, and get back to cooking.
Let's talk a little bit about flavor. You write that people perceive flavor differently, like in the case of cilantro. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is something that I looked into for the New York Times. Why is it that cilantro is so polarizing? In fact, let me just ask the question. How many people in this room detest cilantro? Okay, so it's like 10 or so. How many people love it? Well, lots of people. But 10 is not insignificant. And so the question is, why do some people love it, some people hate it? Why do some cultures use it profusely and others not at all? Cilantro is, in fact, a plant that comes from the Mediterranean area. And to my knowledge, Portugal is really the only country that uses it much at all, of all those countries. But if you go back in history, you see that in Roman times and even later, it was used more. So it's a very interesting ingredient in that way, and way too much to talk about in a newspaper column or talking to you all, but the bottom line for why it is that people either enjoy it or don't, the studies have been done at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. These are people who specialize in taste and smell. And what they found was they were looking to see whether maybe there's a genetic component, maybe some people can detect things in the aroma of cilantro that the rest of us can't, or they're especially sensitive to one element of it. Turns out that that's probably not it, although it might be part of the story. The main thing is, what context did you first encounter cilantro in? You know, we tend these days to think so much about mechanistic explanations for things, you know, the genetics and the chemistry and so on. But a lot of it does have to do with experience. And if you live in a cilantro-loving country, your first encounter with cilantro is going to be in food. Or if you grow up in a household. My mother was born and raised in India, and so there was cilantro around in the foods that I ate from a very early age. Some of the compounds that you find in cilantro aroma are also in soaps and lotions and things that don't belong in your mouth. So if those are the first places where you encountered that element of cilantro aroma, and then at the age of 20 or 25 you encounter cilantro for the first time, you're going to say, that smells like soap, and I'm not going to put it in my mouth. And I talked with a neurobiologist at Northwestern University about this. He works on the brain and how these patterns are built up. And it turned out that he was his own case study on this because he grew up hating cilantro and then had a girlfriend who loved it, so he had to eat it despite his not liking it, and he learned to like it. So it does seem to have to do mostly with the context in which you first experience it and how willing you are to try to overcome that initial reaction.
You're listening to food science writer Harold McGee, whose book is Keys to Good Cooking. He's joined in conversation by Brian Garrick on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So what about taste? They say most of taste is actually smell. So what is the contribution of smell in food?
So, our language is not very good at dealing with this kind of thing. So we talk about food as tasting good, but then we also talk about the sense of taste, which doesn't include smell, even though most of the taste of food is smell. So just to clarify, I prefer, rather than talking about the taste of food, I prefer to talk about flavor. So the overall experience that we have of a food is its flavor. And flavor consists of a couple of components for the most part. One is taste, which is what we detect on our tongue, and the other is smell, which we detect in our nose. And taste is just five sensations that we know of. And that's kind of interesting because when I first started writing about food, it was four. Now it's five. So maybe there's six. I don't know. But sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and umami. And then smell, on the other hand, is almost infinite. Thousands and thousands of aromas that we can detect and remember. And so it's that combination. It's salt, sugar, acidity, bitterness, and umami is MSG, the flavor of MSG. They're kind of the foundation of flavor. That's the way I think about it. And then on that foundation is built a superstructure, which are all the aromas. And so you can have the same foundation, say an apple and a pear can taste about the same if you pinch your nose, the same kind of balance of acidity and sweetness. But then when you open your nose, they're completely different. And that's the superstructure speaking to you, the aromas of pear and apple.
And several years ago, the chef, Daniel Patterson, who's the chef at Qua Restaurant here in San Francisco, put out a book with the perfumer Mandy Aftel. And I know that you've worked a little bit with Mandy and perhaps Daniel as well. So what have you learned from working with a perfumer?
In a way, how to smell. I mean, the amazing thing about Mandy in particular and perfumers in general is that they have amazing instruments in here. They can detect and discriminate among so many different smells. And it's something that I think you are born with certain abilities. Maybe it's like a facility with music. That might be part of it. But it's also training and interest. And so Mandy has what she calls her aroma organ, which looks like a massive organ with keyboard after keyboard after keyboard, except that each key is a vial of a particular scent. And she'll have, we're talking about cilantro, she'll have five different versions of cilantro. Anything you can think of that goes into perfumery and things that go beyond perfumery into the flavors of foods. And there is some overlap. And so I can go there and just sit with her and smell these different things and hear her describe her experience of that, and then I try to get it. And at first, they'll all smell the same to me. All five cilantros will smell the same. But then going back and forth and hearing her say, you know, this one's got a little more of the green, a little bit less of the lotion, and this one has a little bit more citrus aroma to it. That's something that is wonderfully kind of liberating thing to realize about aroma, is that a single thing like cilantro, in fact, is made up of dozens of different components. It's like a chord rather than a single note. And so you can, if you experience it and pay attention enough, you can start to detect the notes in the chord. And that's really exciting. Mm.
You mentioned umami. So what is it? What is umami?
So umami is another one of these very interesting stories. As I say, when I started writing about food in the 70s, there were four tastes: sweet, sour, salt, bitter. End of story. There were people who said the Japanese claim that there is a fifth taste, which is the taste of MSG. In the West, scientists, flavor scientists, said, no, MSG does have an effect on taste, but it's as a modifier of other tastes. So it doesn't have a taste of its own, but it somehow does something to boost the flavor of other things, the tastes of other things. The Japanese insisted, no, this is not just a booster. It has its own distinctive flavor. And it was a standoff for decades until about 10 or 12 years ago when molecular biologists studying the sense of taste discovered on the tongue receptors for umami and demonstrated that in mammals of all kinds there are these receptors and that animals can tell the difference between when it's there and when it's not. And it's not just modifying other things. It has its own distinctive character. So molecular biology made believers out of Western scientists, and now it's accepted that that is a fifth taste.
So what foods are high in umami?
It was originally discovered in dashi, you know, the Japanese broth that's the base for miso soup and all kinds of soups and sauces. And I think that's the reason that the Japanese discovered it, in fact, and not somebody in Europe, for example, because it turns out that a lot of the foods that we eat have a lot of glutamate and also a few other compounds that have similar effects, but they're mixed in with other things. Tomatoes, for example, have a large amount of glutamate. Parmesan cheese is mouthwatering in the way it is because it's got a ton of MSG in it, just as the product of the fermentation and aging. But it's got lots of other stuff too. Salt, for example. The reason I think that the Japanese discovered it was that they make this very simple broth that's essentially nothing but seaweed and water. So a scientist back around the turn of the 20th century was trying to understand flavor and started with something simple like dashi and thought, okay, yeah, it does taste sweet, does taste sour, does taste salty, not so much bitter, but there's something else going on there. And it's because it was such a simple system. And it turns out that the seaweed from which dashi is made stores a tremendous amount of MSG in itself to help balance the salt in salt water. That's why it has so much. So that's how it was discovered, and those are some of the other foods that have lots and lots. Essentially, almost all fermented foods, so cheeses, miso, soy sauce, wines and beers, not as much because they're fermented mainly with yeasts rather than molds and bacteria, but fermented foods in general are very high in umami.
But people think that MSG is bad for you or that it causes what's been called Chinese restaurant syndrome. That's not true, right?
Right. it's one of those things. The Curious Cookbook that I wrote back in 1990 talked about a similar urban myth, the idea that using aluminum cookware would give you Alzheimer's disease. And it turned out that idea came about essentially the same way that the Chinese restaurant idea came about. They were both letters to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. They were not studies, scientific studies. They were kind of observations and questions. I wonder, you know, in the case of pots, in Africa, they make beer out of iron pots and they get iron overload. I wonder if the same thing could be happening to us with aluminum pots and it could be causing brain diseases. It was a question, but that it got reported as, there's a scientific link between aluminum and brain disease. And so the same kind of thing happened with MSG. It then led to hundreds of studies all over the world because MSG is a very common food additive. And if it was a problem, it was going to be a big problem and people wanted to know. So hundreds of studies have been done and they pretty much all come to the same conclusion, which is that if you give someone who reports him or herself as being sensitive to MSG, a placebo or MSG, without, you know, the Chinese meal, they can't tell the difference.
So let's talk about language for a second here. We hear a couple different terms to describe contemporary cuisine: molecular gastronomy, modernist cuisine, techno-emotional cooking. What do you think of these terms?
They're not very appetizing, are they? Especially not the first one. I don't think molecules belong in a description of cooking, because no matter how much chemistry they know, they're not thinking about molecules. They're thinking about ingredients and flavors. That said, I think it is true that in the last 10 years or so, and for this, as I say, I'm very grateful, cooks have become much more interested in science and technology, and they're bringing that kind of toolkit to bear in the kitchen. But I think it's not because they're really interested in science and technology for their own sakes. So I don't think science or technology belong in the name of the cooking. They're interested in innovation. To me, the huge change that's taken place in the last 10 or 15 years is that, whereas in the old days, if you were a professional cook, you were a professional French cook or Italian cook or Japanese cook or fast food cook, you kind of knew what the boundaries were. And the boundaries were set essentially by history, what people came up with in those cultures over the course of centuries. And they came up with those cuisines because they lived in isolation. They had a certain limited set of ingredients and ways to deal with them, and they came up with delicious things by concentrating on, a limited set. Today, it's completely different. The world is open. Any cook can get any ingredient from anywhere in the world, FedExed overnight. You can read a book about, the beautiful Moroccan dishes, and you can be cooking Moroccan even though you've never done it before in your life. So the really creative chefs today, rather than refining a pre-existing cuisine, are interested in exploring and trying new things, trying to come up with new things. So for me, I like experimental, because they're not guaranteeing you anything. They're trying new things, and sometimes they work and a lot of times they don't. Or just, modern, because this is a time of exploration and change, neck-breaking change. And I think that's what we're seeing in the kitchen. It's not really driven by science or technology. It's being driven by the excitement of all of a sudden having this big, wide world to explore.
So one of the people who's led the charge is Ferran Adria. And he's been called by some to be the greatest chef alive. What do you think his contribution has been?
My sense of Ferran's contribution, that's just, everyone calls him Ferran because he has made such a difference to so many people. I thought for a long time that it was introducing the possibility of using science and technology in the kitchen to do things that hadn't been done before. So this kind of innovation in a sort of high-tech way. So he's a guy, for example, who, instead of turning up his nose at industrial ingredients like carrageenan and alginates and things that are used in the food industry as stabilizers, for example, instead of saying, that's industry and I don't bother with that kind of stuff, I do haute cuisine, instead he said, these people use them for that purpose. I wonder if there's anything I can do with them that I can't do with anything else that's kind of cool. And in fact, he did. He came up with a whole series of innovations based on the use of untraditional thickeners that do come from natural sources, but they've been used mostly in the food industry. So I thought that was his main contribution. But then I was in Brazil this last summer, and I went to a restaurant in Sao Paulo where the chef was intent on exploring the kinds of foods that are used in the Amazon and then bringing them to the city and using his restaurant as a way to kind of educate people, Brazilian city people, about the riches of the Amazon. So he was doing nothing high tech. It was showing people things that they've never tasted before, but that's because they've just not been to the Amazon, and the Amazon fruits and vegetables have not come to us. And I was talking with him, and he said, you know, the guy who made what I'm doing possible is Ferran. And he said it was because before Ferran, what I would be doing would be cooking for a very small number of people who happen to have a kind of ethnological interest in the Amazon. And what Ferran showed people was that food could be fascinating in all kinds of ways. He opened our eyes to food as just a much more universal experience, the experience of cooking and eating and sharing food with other people. And he said, I couldn't be doing what I'm doing without that example. So I think his influence has been huge.
So I wanted to see if you had any tips on how to make good latkes, how to make sure that they're crispy on the outside and fully cooked through on the inside.
Yeah. That's the challenge.
Make sure they're not raw in the middle.
It's, you know, there's no substitute for experience. And blowing it a few times and then getting a feeling for what to look for, because so much depends on the thickness of the layer of the mixture that you put into the pan, and then the temperature of the oil. You want the oil in the pan and the pan to be very hot already so that it doesn't take forever to heat up. Otherwise, you're not going to get the outside brown. But you don't want it to be so hot that the outside gets brown before the inside cooks through. So there really isn't a formula. I wish there were. And in fact, this Harvard course that I was participating in was being taught by physicists. My approach is a little more, you know, biology and chemistry. This was being taught by people who love equations. And so this would be right up their line, coming up with a latke equation. You dial in the temperature, the thickness. But the problem is that no matter how good your equation is, everything is changing all the time, right? You got your pan, you measure the temperature. I highly recommend, if you don't have one of these infrared non-contact thermometers. So you can just point it at the pan and it'll tell you you're at 375, which is about where you want to be. It's great. And no cleanup. You don't dip it into anything. You just point it from a distance and then put it in its case and put it away. So you get the pan to the right temperature, put in the latke, the mixture, and immediately the temperature goes down. And then what's important is how high is the flame underneath and how soon do you flip it. And they're just, so it's the best computer for cooking is right here. Mm-hmm. You just have to keep track of everything and get it right.
But doesn't that simply measure that kind of thermometer, just the outside part? So say I have a pot of water or a stew or a roast, won't it just take the temperature of the exterior only?
That's right. And that's something you really have to worry about, for example, if you are taking the temperature of a stew or a roast. Because both of those things are moist, they're evaporating water. And evaporation in cooking is like perspiration for us. We perspire in order to cool ourselves down. And so if you take the temperature, the external temperature of a roast, you're going to get not only not the temperature on the inside, but an inaccurate temperature for the surface, because the surface itself is actually hotter, but because it's evaporating, what you're measuring is the evaporation and not the actual surface, and it's going to give you a falsely low reading. But you can use it in latke making because you start out with a pan and oil does not perspire. Oil doesn't have any water in it, so the temperature of the oil is an accurate reflection of the temperature of the rest of the oil and pan.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features food science writer Harold McGee, whose book is Keys to Good Cooking. He's joined in conversation by Brian Garrick. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
In addition to this kind of thermometer, what are your essential pieces of cooking equipment that we should be buying this time of year, okay, or any time of year?
Okay. A second thermometer. In fact, I should put together a little kit, shouldn't I? If you want this, you also want that. It's amazing to me that cooking is essentially ingredients plus heat. That's really what it comes down to. Of course, lots of other mixing and stuff like that, but essentially cooking comes down to ingredients and heat. And we can measure ingredients pretty well by weight or by volume, but we still mostly don't measure temperature very well. And so never trust your thermostat on the oven. Have one of these point-and-shoot guys to measure the temperature inside your oven, and it's going to be different temperatures, different places. You can put things in the back where it's hotter or toward the front where it's cooler. But then you also want a thermometer that does measure accurately inside the meat or the whatever it is you're cooking. It's great for cakes, for bread, for all kinds of things. And the problem with your standard instant read, so-called instant read thermometer, even if it's a digital one, is that, in fact, it takes about 10 seconds to reach the actual temperature that you're trying to measure. And it's got a big probe that leaves a big hole every time you stick it in. And it's not that accurate, but because since it has such a big shaft, and the shaft is metal, you stick it in, the first thing the shaft does is cool down whatever it's in contact with. So you're always getting a lower reading than is actually there, and that means that you overcook things. So go online and look for these wonderful thermometers that have essentially a syringe-like tip. It's very, very small. It does measure instantly, I mean, in a second. And it leaves a tiny little hole so that you can measure several different places and no one's ever going to see it. And it gives you an instantaneous measurement, which means that the most important thing about cooking meat, fish, poultry is to check the temperature early and often. There is no formula for knowing how long is long enough. You have to check and see when it's been long enough. And that thermometer will tell you. So those two thermometers, and then I really do recommend a digital scale because it is so much more accurate to measure something as simple and as important as salt. If a cookbook tells you to use a tablespoon of salt and they don't specify and they're using Morton's granulated and you're using Diamond Kosher, you're going to be off by a factor of two. There's twice as much actual salt in a tablespoon of Morton's granulated than there is in kosher because the kosher is flaky and there's a lot of air in that tablespoon. So you really want to measure all ingredients when you can by weight and not by volume.
Let's talk for a minute about some of these new techniques and pieces of equipment. My favorite is the rotary evaporator. I'm wondering if you could talk about this fun gadget.
Okay. You know, a lot of these things have been in laboratories for decades. Cooks discovered them over the last 5 or 10 years, and it's like, you know, discovering something new, except that they're not new to a lot of people. So the rotary evaporator is essentially a distillation device. It's a still. And it operates on the same principle as you're making a stew and you leave the lid ajar on the stew, and you know how you'll get liquid that condenses on the lid because it's not as hot as the stew is, so the vapors come up, hit the lid, condense. A rotary evaporator or a still essentially is a way of collecting that condensation in a systematic way. And what happens is that aromas come off and leave everything else behind. So no salt, no sugar, no fat, no protein, none of that stuff come out of the food, but the aromas come out. And so what you can do with a rotovap, as it's called in the trade, is put something in there and distill off the aroma and then use that aroma in ways that are novel. And the most remarkable and one of the first experiences I had of that was in Spain. Spain is the place where a lot of this stuff has been kind of fermenting to begin with. I had an oyster that was presented in a clear jelly, and it was presented to me as oyster and earth. And in Spain, there is this, what we would call surf and turf, or there it's mar y montaña, sea and mountain, so animal and fish combined in the same dish. And so I thought it was going to be something like that, but clear, and usually clear jelly makes you think of, I don't know, champagne or something like that. So I popped it in my mouth, not quite knowing what to expect. Tasted the oyster just fine, and I couldn't figure out what the jelly flavor was because it wasn't familiar. And kept thinking, kept paying attention to it, and then finally realized that the description was literal, that it was the aroma of earth. And what the chef had done was taken a handful of soil, put it in the rotovap, evaporated off the aroma of soil, and then used that in the clear jelly to give it the aroma of the earth. And it was earth in a good way, you know, not dirty, but, you know, just a hint of it, so that it was like, you know, eating an oyster while you're walking through the forest or something like that. This chef's brother, who's the pastry chef at the restaurant, does things like using the rotovap to get the aromas of chocolate and coffee, and then he'll make desserts using those flavors, but he'll put them into things that, again, we think of those as dark, right? Brown. But he'll put them in a clear, like a sorbet. It looks like a lemon sorbet, and you bite into it, and it's the strongest coffee-flavored sorbet you've ever had in your life, but no visual connection to that flavor. So that's the kind of game you can play with the rotovap.
Do you think that any of these pieces of equipment are going to trickle down to the home chef?
The rotovap probably not, well, at least not until it's made much more foolproof. It costs $10,000, and the beaker, you know, it's got all these moving glass parts, and if you break one, well, that's $600 and a technician call. So that's going to be a while. Maybe they'll make it out of silicone eventually. But the one that's in the process of making it to the home cook is the immersion circulator, sometimes referred to as sous vide. And that gets back to my point about temperature. Cooking is all about temperature, and thermometers are great, but they just tell you what temperature it is. They don't help you control it. The great thing about the immersion circulator is that, which is essentially a thermometer and a heating element and a little pump to circulate the water, you take this and put it in a pot of water, and then you can control the temperature of that pot of water to a tenth of a degree. So you can take that steak that you want to be 140 degrees and put it in that pot of water and get it to exactly 140 degrees and then take it out and sear the outside to get the wonderful caramel Maillard flavors and have a perfectly done steak. Mm-hmm. And that's what restaurants have been doing now for probably close to 20 years at this point. You know, talk to a biologist, it's a water bath, and they've had them for decades. Still a little pricey, but price will come down.
About the same cost as a KitchenAid mixer.
Yeah.
So after all your time in the kitchen, are there things that still continue to baffle you that are mysterious?
All kinds of things. Okay, the other day, there were great chanterelles at the Alemany Market. Mm. So I bought a bunch, and I learned to cook chanterelles from a mushroom picker in France, who said there's only one way to cook chanterelle. It's the difference between tradition and modern chefs. Modern chefs can say, how many ways can I cook chanterelles? He said, no, you put them in a pan, you turn up the heat, they leak a lot of their liquid. The moment they begin to dry out, throw in a little garlic, very finely chopped, 30 seconds, and then a handful of parsley, a little bit of salt, done. Olive oil, a little olive oil in there as well. south of France. So that's the way I've always done it. So I buy these chanterelles, and that's what I'm going to do. And I notice for the first time that, you know, I'm doing this. They smell like chanterelles just fine. Throw in the garlic, smells like garlicky chanterelle. Throw in the parsley, and all of a sudden I get this big whiff of cinnamon. The smell of cinnamon. There's no cinnamon within 10 feet of this pan. So for me, the ongoing and biggest mystery and most interesting thing and subject about which I'm going to write my next book is flavor. You know, how does that happen? What's going on? Why do chanterelles taste like chanterelles in the first place, and garlic like garlic, and parsley like parsley, and why when you mix them together sometimes this sort of alchemical thing happens and you end up with not the sum of the parts but something completely different? So that's an example.
Sounds tasty.
They were good. They were good.
Yeah. So let's open it up to questions from the audience.
I'm going to ask a very basic question, but I'm also going to ask you to settle a marital dispute between my husband and I. My husband is not here tonight, unfortunately. Does water boil faster with the lid on the pot or off the pot?
What does your husband say?
Is that fair since he's not here to defend himself? He espouses the pot with no lid.
Boils faster, he says.
He says.
Okay.
Yes.
One other question. Typically, what volume of water are you boiling?
Like for pasta, a large pot of water.
Okay, yeah. You're right and he's wrong.
He'll be happy he's not here tonight.
it has to do with what I mentioned before about evaporation. So if the lid is off, then you're heating the bottom of the pot. The water is getting hot, but then the water at the very surface is evaporating off and cooling it down. If you put the lid on, you prevent that evaporation from happening. And what you should do is a race. Two pots side by side, same volume of water, one pot, one lid on, one lid off, and you'll see that you come out probably by minutes. It'll come to the boil faster.
Actually, if I tell him that you said that it boils faster with the lid on, I think he might believe that.
So I'm going to have to ask the double question. The first is, if it's all about heat transfer, is it gas or electric? Does it actually make a difference? And the second question is, if I was going to explain an interesting chemical reaction that leads to cooking to a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old, what would be the more interesting one?
Gas versus electric. Stovetop or oven? Stovetop. Okay. Electric gives you much more rapid and fine-tuned control over the heat output, but it's also way less efficient than electric. So you waste a tremendous amount of energy using gas. You waste much less using electric. You waste the least, like about 5%, with induction. And induction actually gives you as quick a temperature change as gas does. The problem with induction is that you don't have the same visual cue. You can see the flame. You can't see the induction. But induction, if you're redoing a kitchen, thinking about redoing a stovetop, induction is, as I say, 95% efficient. Gas is maybe 40% efficient. And electric is maybe 70 or 80%. So tremendous differences. The best chemical reaction is caramelization. So you take sugar. Already you've got them hooked, right? Sugar is sweet. It has no aroma whatsoever. You put it in a pan, you turn on the heat, it melts and it turns brown and develops the aroma of caramel. So from something that initially had no aroma whatsoever, you end up with this aroma that fills the kitchen. And if you taste the caramel, caramel, instead of just being sweet, is now sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. All of them. Because you've taken that single molecule, sucrose, and you've turned it into hundreds and hundreds of other molecules. That, to me, is the epitome of the alchemy of cooking.
I noticed that most cooks that cook meat They don't cut into it right away. They wait about half an hour before they cut into it. Why do they do that, and what is happening?
Yeah, that's called resting the meat. And it's done because if you cut the meat immediately after you take it off the heat, it's really juicy, and the juices come pouring out, and then they're not in the meat anymore. It looks great on your plate, but they're not inside the meat where they're going to make the meat juicy. If you let, say, a steak or a chop sit for 10 minutes, and then you cut into it, much less of the juice comes out, which means it's in the meat as you chew it that it comes out. And it's for a couple of reasons that essentially have to do with the fact that the proteins inside a piece of meat are kind of like a sponge. It's meat is 75% water and maybe 15% protein. But that 15% is able to hold all that 75% of the water. The moment you start to heat it, you begin to essentially cause the sponge to contract. And some of that contraction is reversible. So when you stop the heating, some of the fibers relax and they're able to hang on to the moisture that they would otherwise just leak right away. And the other thing is that the juices themselves at, say, 140 degrees, if you've cooked it just right, they're very thin because the higher the temperature of a liquid, the runnier it gets. The lower the temperature, the thicker it gets. And so if you let it cool down to, say, 120, it's still warm, in fact, feels hot to us. But the juices are less runny. So even those that do want to come out of the meat take longer to flow, and so they end up staying inside. So bottom line, the meat's juicier.
Hi. On our way out, teach us about how you look at a new restaurant. What can you tell from looking at food on other people's plates? What do you see on a menu that is interesting to you, and what would you maybe avoid no matter how often it appears on a menu?
Well, the first thing I do when I look at a menu is for things that I've never heard of before or have never had before. So if there's an ingredient listed and I have never heard of it before, then chances are I'm certainly going to put that on my list and then come back to it and maybe get it. Because for me, the great thing about eating is that we have to do it, and we have to do it several times a day. And it's a chance to experience the world in a way that we really don't get to otherwise. So new ingredients, new ways of putting things together, that's what really excites me.
Okay. Thank you, audience. And thank you, Harold McGee.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was food science writer Harold McGee, whose book is Keys to Good Cooking. He was joined in conversation by Brian Garrick. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.